Welcome to BioTalk from Biotechnics. I am Florence Blanchard. In this episode of BioTalk, we will discuss emerging technologies in stem cell biology with my guest Dr. Ken Frana, Chair of the Department of Pharmacology at Penn State University College of Medicine, and Ken Aldrich, CEO of International Stem Cell Corporation. Embryonic cells from an early developmental stage called blastocyst are pluripotent. They are able to give rise to any of the 200 cell types that are present in the adult body. For this reason, these cells have tremendous therapeutic potential. However, embryonic stem cell research has raised such ethical controversy that in 2001, the American federal government banned funding on any research that would involve embryonic stem cells. This ban was only recently lifted by President Barack Obama. Because of the ethical controversy, new types of pluripotent stem cells have emerged as alternatives to embryonic stem cells. These include induced pluripotent stem cells, or iPS cells, and parthenogenic stem cells. Later in this episode of BioTalk, Ken Aldrich will discuss the ban on federal funding of embryonic stem cell research, but first I asked Dr. Ken Frana to talk about the current state of stem cell research. Ken Frana has recently co-authored a review titled Emerging Molecular Approaches in Stem Cell Biology, which was published in the April 2009 special issue of Biotechnics.
Embryonic stem cells, especially human embryonic stem cells, are very social creatures. They like to have neighboring cells and a very rich environment in which to grow. And so up until now, what that has required is that the embryonic stem cell be grown on top of a layer of mouse fibroblasts. Mouse cells, when growing on a tissue culture dish, release factors into the solution that surrounds them. And for reasons that we don't understand, those factors make embryonic stem cells particularly happy. That environment keeps them de-differentiated, and it maintains their pluripotency. And so one of the things we've been doing in my own laboratory for a number of years is try to figure out how to avoid using the mouse feeder cells. And so we filed a patent 2 years ago for using a small molecule bioactive lipid, a small fatty acid-like molecule that allows us to grow human embryonic stem cells without using the mouse feeder cell. So that's one aspect of how the field needs to develop. We need to find a way to get away from the mouse cells because they tend to contaminate the embryonic cell culture. And then what we've been trying to also figure out is then how do we make them do what we want them to do? How do we make them turn into neurons that might be used to treat Parkinson's disease? Or how might we convince them or coax them to become beta cells of the pancreas so that we could treat type 1 diabetes?
One characteristic of cancer cells is that they exhibit abnormal growth or division, which is reminiscent of embryonic stem cells. How much in common do these two types of cells have?
Embryonic stem cells, or stem cells in general, and cancer cells share a lot in common. They both tend to be immortal. They both tend to ignore growth arrest signals, so they divide when other cells would stop dividing and stop growing. And so it's a big concern that if we use them as therapeutic tools, are they going to become a cancer? In fact, one of the ways we test stem cells is to implant them in a mouse model that won't reject them. And what they do is, as you point out, is they continue to divide and they will begin to differentiate, and you will see signs of all of the various cell types in the body in this benign tumor, which is called a teratoma. So one of the things that's most important to understand ultimately is what makes the difference between a cancer cell and a stem cell. And in fact, perhaps the hottest area in cancer biology right now is the concept of the cancer stem cell, that cancer comes from a stem cell that is growing out of control, that has ignored all of the stop signs that tell it to not divide or to stay where it is. For instance, in the bone marrow, we have adult stem cells that lead to production of red blood cells and white blood cells. Something is telling them under normal conditions, don't divide out of control, don't leave the bone marrow, and that what can happen is that when there's a defect of some kind, it's possible that some of the blood cancers, the leukemias, for instance, might be derived from a stem cell growing out of control. But it's a very real concern that if we use stem cells as a therapeutic, could we perhaps cause a cancer? And so one of the things that's becoming clear is that when stem cells do decide to differentiate, when they do decide to become a cell type in the body, and let's just say a brain cell, they are what is termed terminally differentiated. They have gone down that path and they're stuck there. They will not de-differentiate back to a stem cell. Now, our problem is that we're not sure how to make that 100% efficient. And so there are a lot of groups studying that. How do we make them differentiate and stay put and not divide anymore and not cause a tumor?
The possibility to derive induced pluripotent stem cell lines from adult somatic cells is an exciting advance in the field. iPSL lines were first reported in humans in November 2007 by two independent groups, one in Japan led by Dr. Shinya Yamanaka and one in Wisconsin led by Dr. James Thompson. What made these two groups able to de-differentiate adult cells?
What they discovered was, through a rather complex series of studies to tell the difference between a normal cell and a stem cell, what they found was that there were a number of factors that could be used to trick a skin cell into becoming a stem cell. The way this works is that because we replace our skin frequently, skin cells are like adult stem cells in some respects. That is, they will continually divide. Fibroblasts will divide in culture. Ultimately, they will senesce or grow old and die, but they are already designed to divide and replace themselves. What Yamanaka and Thompson's groups found was that if we then take those cells, which are already in a kind of dividing state, and we put in key transcription factors, key regulators of the nucleus, we can turn them into something that looks like a stem cell. And that's why they're called induced pluripotent stem cells. They were induced through the introduction of these transcription factors to become stem cell-like. The transcription factors, it shouldn't be a surprise, are to a large extent nuclear programming proteins. And in fact, proteins that have been previously described to have this potential. One example is a protein called OCT4. OCT4 is a transcription factor found in the nucleus of stem-like cells and has, for a number of years, been used as a marker of stem cells. Another example is a protein called c-MYC, and c-MYC has been known for 30 years as a cancer-causing gene related to cells growing out of control. And so in some respects, it's not surprising that these worked. In other respects, they're proteins, they turned out to be proteins that we have very little knowledge about, and one of those is a protein called KLF4. But without going into the complete detail of it, what these investigators did was put the genes for these transcription factors into viruses and then infect skin cells with these viruses. And as a result, what happened is the cells did not senesce and in fact changed their behavior so they looked no longer like a skin cell but looked like an embryonic stem cell. And so there's been quite a bit of work now to characterize those cells. And in fact, the Thompson group has quite generously provided us with cell cultures from their iPS cells, and we're trying to figure out what makes those cells tick.
You mentioned that cancer research has helped shed light on stem cell molecular properties. Could stem cell research help us understand cancer?
That's a terrific observation, because we have learned a lot about how stem cells grow from our previous work on cancer cells, including these stem cell markers that were used to make iPS. What we're hoping is that by better understanding stem cells, we might be able to better understand how to stop or block cancer. And so there's a lot of, again, a lot of work going on in a lot of different laboratories trying to figure out what happens if we knock down, what happens if we reduce these transcription factors or some of them? Can we change the behavior of a stem cell and by inference also change the behavior of a cancer cell?
What particular aspect of stem cell research is your lab focused on?
For the last several years, my own research group has been most interested in a very fundamental aspect of stem cells. How does the nucleus direct their pluripotency and their immortality? And so what we've been doing is collecting various types of stem cells. So we have adult stem cells, iPS cells, as I mentioned earlier. We have embryonic stem cells, and we have cancer stem cells. And we've been comparing them to each other by collecting their nucleus and then comparing them using state-of-the-art proteomic tools, discovery tools that tell us what's different between an adult stem cell, a bone marrow stem cell, for instance, and an embryonic stem cell. And one of the things that we found early on in the last 2 years is that stem cells are inherently very different. And we're now studying how the induced pluripotent stem cell is different from the embryonic stem cell. And what we're finding is that there are a series of key transcription factors and RNA processing enzymes that are differentially expressed depending on what kind of cell you are. So, for instance, when we take an embryonic stem cell and we coax it into becoming a neural progenitor, the precursor of neurons, we find that there are a number of key proteins like OCT4, like c-MYC, that are very different between those two cells. And what we're working on at this very moment is coaxing the adult stem cell to become an embryonic stem cell. So it strikes us that rather than starting with a skin cell, we may be able to start with what's called a bone marrow mesenchymal stem cell, an adult stem cell that's destined to become bone or cartilage. And our current notion is that it should be easier to convince it to become an embryonic stem cell. And so we're trying to do those experiments right now. But this is just one tool. There have been a number of studies of embryonic stem cells using functional genomics that have started to tell us what makes a stem cell a stem cell. What determines stemness? Doug Melton in Boston coined the term stemness gene to reflect a cadre of gene products that seem to determine what makes a stem cell tick. We are focusing now on the proteins that modulate those genes. And it appears that there's going to be a relatively unique fingerprint, a nuclear proteome, if you will, that reflects the given state of a stem cell. And one of the things that we hope to find using this approach is that we can define what makes an embryonic stem cell different from an adult stem cell, or what makes a cancer stem cell grow out of control and lead to a neoplasia, as opposed to taking an embryonic stem cell and using it to treat Alzheimer's disease without creating a tumor. Those are fundamental biology questions that need to be addressed before we can move on to the therapeutics.
Does the nuclear proteome that reflects the given state of a stem cell include factors that function in other physiological processes, or are these factors unique to stem cell properties?
So, Florence, I think that's an important question. And I think that is the biggest concern right now, is that we are finding proteins that appear to be involved in a lot of different processes. By way of example, we did an experiment comparing the bone marrow adult stem cell to the embryonic stem cell, studying the nuclear proteins. And using advanced bioinformatics, we were able to illuminate a very interesting pathway that appears to converge on c-MYC as a central component. Well, because of our tools, we couldn't see c-MYC. It is relatively rare, and it didn't show up in our screen. But because everything was pointing at c-MYC, we just tested the hypothesis. Well, is it possible that c-MYC is being differentially regulated? And what we found was that in embryonic stem cells, c-MYC is present at something like 17 times higher levels than it is in the adult stem cell. What this tells us is two things. The first is it may be possible to manipulate with a drug that pathway without having to infect cells with viruses, which, by the way, is right now the biggest impediment to the iPS field, is that in order to create iPS, we infect skin cells with retroviruses, for instance, carrying these gene factors. Well, from this network analysis, we may be able to find a unique target, a unique protein that we have a small molecule, we have a drug for, that might convince, in our case, an adult stem cell to become an embryonic stem cell. But circling back to your original question, do they subserve normal functions? And it is very interesting that these pathways, I would say two-thirds of the proteins that we identify as being different between different kinds of stem cells, they have other jobs, they have other functions, and what they appear to do is contribute to this network that controls the behavior of the cell in terms of immortality and pluripotency. So we're left with the possibility that it's not going to be a single master switch, but a panel of changes that reflect what a cell does or how it behaves. And we're going to have to get around that, because therapeutics that might help us with the stem cell might turn out to have a deleterious effect on some other physiology. And we just don't know enough to answer that question yet.
Another recent and exciting discovery is the possibility to create a stem cell line by way of parthenogenesis. What is your personal take on this technology?
I was at the Wake Forest University School of Medicine back in the late 90s, working with a colleague trying to understand alcoholism. And so we were using a model of alcoholism that involved the non-human primate, the small cynomolgus macaque. And what we set out to do was working with Jose Sibeli, who at that time was at Advanced Cell Technology. We set out to try and clone an alcoholic monkey. We wanted to use a tool called somatic cell nuclear transfer cloning to ask a very important but simple question. If we use the skin cell of an alcoholic monkey to create a clone of that monkey, would it be destined for alcoholism? Turns out that we know alcoholism runs in families, but that very experiment has never been done before. Well, just as an aside, we worked very hard to try and clone that monkey or those monkeys and were unsuccessful. But along the way, in order to accomplish that, we were making large numbers of eggs from donor females with the idea that we would take nuclei from skin cells and put them into the eggs and use them to create clones. And what happened was that Jose called us one day and said, listen, why don't we try something different? There is a report that you can activate the egg without sperm and create something called a parthenote. Parthenogenesis comes from the Greek word partheno, which means virgin, and genesis, which means birth. And in lower organisms like fish and snakes and insects, parthenogenesis is very common. When the environment is rich, what will happen is that the female just start activating their eggs. So an example would be the drone honeybee. The drone is a parthenote. Well, this doesn't occur frequently in mammals because there is a key imprinting factor delivered by the sperm that allows the placenta to form. So you can activate mammalian eggs and they'll look like a blastocyst in every respect. They develop normally up to the blastocyst stage, but if you implant them back in the womb, they'll fail to implant because there's a defect in the trophectoderm. But note what I just said. They'll look just like an embryo up until that point. And that means they form a blastocyst, which means they should be able to be used to make a stem cell line. And that's what we did back in 2000, 2001, is that Jose and Kathy Grant and I put together a team that showed that what you could do is take monkey eggs, trick them into thinking they're fertilized, they'll develop up to the blastocyst stage, and then you can use them to create an embryonic stem cell line. And that has since been shown to be true in humans as well. So the cells that are produced by parthenogenesis, by all of our criteria, look just like embryonic stem cells. But they have one unique advantage and potentially one unique disadvantage. The advantage is that these are embryonic stem cells that are produced from non-viable embryos. Even if those embryos are put back in the womb, they will not become a fetus. They cannot form a placenta. And so on one hand, that provides an ethical alternative because while you must destroy the blastocyst, it's a non-viable blastocyst. The disadvantage, potential disadvantage, is that these are uniparental. And all that means is that they get all their chromosomes from the female, and so they don't have any sperm factors. And we already know that there's a key sperm factor that's necessary for forming the placenta. Who knows if there's anything else that that sperm imprinting is necessary for, characterized in the human parthenogenetic stem cell, and so there's still a lot of work to be done. But this adds a very important tool to the toolbox because it has the ethical advantage of not destroying a viable embryo, but producing a cell that looks very much like an embryonic stem cell.
That was Dr. Ken Vrana, chair of the Department of Pharmacology at Penn State University College of Medicine. You can read more about the current state of stem cell research in his review titled Emerging Molecular Approaches in Stem Cell Biology, which was published in the April 2009 special issue of Biotechnics. Ken Aldrich, co-founder and CEO of International Stem Cell Corporation, provides researchers with parthenogenic stem cell line. I spoke with him and asked him to explain how the ban on federal funding has affected the field of stem cell research and his company.
Certainly for the last 10 years or so, research involving embryonic stem cells, and for that matter, parthenogenic stem cells, has been caught up in both the presidential ban and the ban introduced in what's called the Dickey-Wicker Amendment, which prohibited in various ways the use of any federal funding. More troublesome than that, however, was the fear on behalf of academic institutions that if they used any kind of stem cells, they ran the risk of losing all of their federal funding. If it could be proven that even $1 of federal funding went into the stem cell research, the great fear was that the government would cut off all funding. The recent announcement by the Obama administration that they're going to lift that ban, I think, is enormously important, more because it removes that fear than because of the specific dollars that may flow into the industry. There is, I believe, something like $10 billion, though, in the new stimulus package, which at least some of which can go to stem cell research. So that funding will come potentially from that source. Private funding obviously has carried the industry in this country up until now. It's been a mixture of private, public funding, and funding through corporations such as ours, which have raised money in the capital markets to do our own research.
How did individual states respond to the Dickey-Wicker Amendment?
But a lot of states instituted their own programs. California, I think, was probably the leader in that with a $3 billion program that was passed a couple of years ago. And that program has begun to fund. They fund primarily to academic institutions, but small amounts of that money have actually gone into some private companies. Maryland has a program. New Jersey has a program. And there are probably many more that I'm not familiar with because we're not involved in those particular states. But yes, there has been state funding. I don't think it's been, for the most part, has not been in extremely large amounts, but it has probably done a lot of good in academic funding that we'll begin to see the results of in a few years.
What made the derivation of human parthenogenic stem cell lines possible?
Parthenogenesis is something that scientists have been trying to do for many years because it's known that various animals can reproduce parthenogenically without the introduction of sperm. No one had ever been able to develop a true stem cell line from that process until our scientists were able to do that, actually did it in 06, and we published in 07. The difficulty always was that no one could get those stem cell lines to live long enough to form a true immortal line. And that was the breakthrough that our chief scientist at International Stem Cell, her name is Dr. Elena Rovaseva, and she was for many years the chief scientist in cell biology in the Soviet Union, came to the U.S. After the breakup of the Soviet Union, is now a U.S. citizen and has been our chief scientist for many years. She saw a way to do that, and it ultimately turned out to be relatively simple. It involved control of oxygen levels and temperature in a way that simply had not been done before. So that's the primary difference. Another breakthrough, though, that was very important was the establishment of what we call a homozygous parthenote. Basically, the homozygous parthenote is a true diploid cell, but in the process, when it throws off the first polar body, which is basically throwing off half the DNA in order to make room for the sperm's DNA, in this case, the DNA that remains replicates itself. That makes a huge difference because now we can take a single stem cell line, if it comes from a donor with a common HLA pattern, and we can match literally hundreds of millions of people to organ transplant standards. So the goal of that, obviously, is to solve the big problem that everyone has had with stem cells, which is rejection. What we are doing is actively seeking donors who have the most common haplotypes, so that if we can make a cell line from the most common donors with the most common haplotypes, then we can match a very large segment of the population. For example, our very first cell line, partly by luck and partly because we were trying to do that, statistically at least, will match about 350 million people and roughly 5% of the U.S. population. Others will match a much smaller group. So the goal is to develop ultimately a bank of about 50 to 100 cell lines, which will match most of the world population. By contrast, the estimates are if you tried to do that with traditional embryonic stem cells, you might end up with anywhere from 1,000 to 100,000 lines. So it gives us something that we think will make a huge difference in trying to establish a source of cells that functions, quite frankly, very much like a blood bank does today. Science is more complicated, the matching is more complicated, but the concept is the same. This is particularly important for certain kinds of situations. For example, if you have liver disease, acute liver failure, whether it's liver disease induced or induced by trauma, there is no such thing as dialysis for the liver. So you will either get a transplant or you will die. And it's been proven for many years that if you can transplant liver cells, you can often keep a patient alive long enough to get to a transplant. But there's, again, a huge problem of finding those cells. Some of the principals in my company 15 or 20 years ago were harvesting liver cells from cadavers for exactly this market. So it's a technology we know works. But as you can imagine, if you're trying to get liver cells from cadavers, you get the diseased and the alcoholic. What we want to do is get pure and pristine cells so that if a patient is in liver failure, they can get treatment immediately. And the same could be applied, obviously, in other diseases. That you can't do by taking their cells, waiting for them to regrow because they won't live that long. It's a sad fact, but that's the reality. So all of the different cell types, stem cell types, have, I think, a legitimate and different function. A lot of this debate that goes on of which is better and which is worse is, to my mind, a sort of a pointless debate. They're going to fill different niches in the need for stem cells. We think that solving immune problems is a huge one, and that's what we're focused on.
How do you know that your parthenogenic cell lines can differentiate into all adult cell types?
The short answer is we're doing it. Now, you know, all of the cells, who knows? We don't know that embryonic stem cells will ultimately make all of them, but we think they probably will. But the real critical test is, can you do the things that have already been done with embryonic cells? And so far, every indication is that we can do that. We have reproduced retinal pigment epithelial cells, which are the critical cells for treatment of macular degeneration. We have reproduced what are called definitive endoderm, which is the last step before you get to a true liver cell or hepatic cell. Again, that's as far as anyone has gone with embryonic cells. We've produced beating heart cells. We've produced, interestingly, we've produced in the laboratory something I think no one has ever done, which is to create a complete self-assembling corneal construct growing in a petri dish.
What are the goals of International Stem Cell Corporation?
The basics of our research and our business model are that we do not believe that we as a company are the best equipped to find cures for diseases. We think we are among, if not the best equipped, certainly one of the best equipped to provide the cells that can be used in those treatments. So what we do is we provide the cells. For example, we're working with a researcher in Germany who's been working on Alzheimer's and other related diseases. We're working with a well-known researcher at the University of San Francisco who's working on liver disease, and we're working closer to home at the UC Irvine on macular degeneration. In each case, what we do is we provide the cells, we ask the researchers to help us find the best ways to differentiate our stem cells into the particular cells they need, and then we collaborate throughout the whole process, ultimately including FDA or foreign governmental review. So the model for us is not to control the diseases, not to in any way be a roadblock for any kind of research, but to be the implementing force. Our profit as a company will ultimately come by providing those cells and being the supplier, because academic researchers are not equipped or in the business of producing cells actually for use in the clinic or under government and CGMP controlled conditions. We are. So it's a very nice symbiotic relationship that I think will grow. Many researchers, for example, are using our cells in parallel with embryonic cells or iPS cells to see which works best for their particular application, and we welcome that.
That was Ken Aldrich, co-founder and CEO of International Stem Cell Corporation. Even though the federal ban on funding embryonic stem cell research has been lifted, the controversy still remains as the National Institutes of Health attempts to define guidelines for this funding. Scientists believe that stem cells have the potential to cure many diseases, but how with that research we proceed remains unclear. I would like to thank Dr. Kent Vrana and Ken Aldrich for speaking with me on this subject. Thank you for listening to this episode of BioTalk from Biotechnics. I am Florence Blanchard.